This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 313 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by co-host Max Strescott, our resident pilot and CFI. Max, how you doing?
Oh, hello there. It's a guest co-host substituting for Rob Mark, who is off writing his book this summer.
And I guess he must be making some progress because we have heard word that he'll be back maybe in a couple of weeks.
Well, I guess that's appropriate then. He's had his summer vacation.
Yes. All right. You know, he's going to make us all read his book. We'll have to give him a book report or something.
Well, I've actually been passing stories along to him, so I'm hoping some of them show up in there. Well, none with my name, of course.
Okay. Well, David Vanderhoof, our other co-host, is off this week. David, of course, is our aviation historian and military aviation expert. He also pens the What Just Flew By blog. We look for David to rejoin us next week. Now, our guest this episode, I'm very excited. Our guest this episode is Kathy Babbis. Now, most of Kathy's professional experience has been in the aviation industry. She's a pilot, flight instructor, ground instructor, air traffic controller for a while, weather observer, and aviation chart cartographer. And not only that, she's a stand-up comedian, so she'll fit right in here. Kathy, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hi, guys.
Now, currently, your current job is with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the NGA. That sounds it sounds kind of interesting and a little bit serious. What's the short version of what you're doing there?
Well, the short version is that NGA has two functions in the executive agency. We're both an intelligence agency like the DIA and NSA, but we're also a combat support agency. And my part of NGA supports mostly the combat support agency side of our business. And what I do is we have an entire organization that makes instrument flying charts for military pilots to use to fly worldwide. That's the very short version. We make things just like the FAA airport facility directories and the NACO instrument charts, but we do that for the whole world. The military pilots use the FAA-produced products in the United States.
Wow, great. That sounds very serious. And we're going to talk about that some more coming up. But I just wanted to ask real quick, do you get many of your jokes from work?
No,
I didn't think so. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to try and probe the mind of this very interesting lady who is single, I hear. Is that right, Kathy?
Single and looking.
Okay. Well, we'll see what we can do along the way, because I guess you're kind of looking for someone who's in aviation or maybe even a pilot, aren't you?
That would be great. Someone with flight benefits. And true love.
All right. Very good. What a combination.
It sounds like she might be misguided. And the flight benefits and the true love, I don't know. Can you find both together?
And dancing. They have to dance,
there you
too.
Go.
Oh, boy.
Now I've just cut out like 98% of your
exactly.
audience.
I know. Yeah. The dancing part. Oh, boy.
You've cut out the geek part of our audience.
Yes. Yes. All right. Well, also this episode, we're going to talk about some of the current aviation topics, some things in the news. As we mentioned, David's off this week, so no history segment. Also, no Australia desk this week. Grant and Steve are otherwise engaged, and so we'll look forward to hearing from them again next time. But we do have an Across the Pond segment from Peter. He talks about the Lancaster Bomber 2014 UK tour, also something called Vulcan to the Sky. So we'll have that coming up. And we have a little bit of listener feedback. And we also have, of course, our T-shirt winner for this week. Now, if you've been listening for the last few episodes, you know that we've been conducting a listener survey. And each week we've been drawing a name out of the hat. And the winner gets a T-shirt. There's only a little bit of time left. So if you haven't taken the survey yet, you know, get your name in the hat. Once you go in the hat, you stay in the hat. So the sooner you participate in the survey, the more chances you have of winning. If you haven't taken the survey, that's at airplanegeeks.com/survey2014. But let's find out which listener wins the Airplane Geeks T-shirt this week.
And our winner this week, Jim Carnahan. And Jim, you have been selected randomly. I actually wanted to choose the people who said that the best part of the show was the co-host, but we really did choose this randomly. And we will be sending a T-shirt to you. If you haven't heard from us by the time you get this podcast, go ahead and shoot us an email and we'll get that T-shirt to you.
All right. Very good. With that, let's get started with the aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Our first story comes from Aviation Today. This is Business Aviation's second quarter comeback. Now, this comes from a report published by Jet Support Services Incorporated, JSSI. And JSSI, they track the number of hours that business aircraft fly according to region and industry and aircraft type and things like that. I guess JSSI's business is to provide maintenance and financial services to the business aviation industry. According to their Business Aviation Index, second quarter 2014, global business aviation activity grew by 8% quarter over quarter and also 3% year over year. 8% the quarter over quarter sounds like that's a pretty healthy gain.
Oh, it certainly is. And I think that just shows that the economy overall is starting to rebound. Typically, business aviation follows pretty closely with the economy. I think it's actually a leading indicator. So that's good. This might mean that we've still got a lot of good growth in the economy ahead.
Yeah, and the business aviation sector, it's been kind of the lagging sector compared to other aviation areas, sort of the last one to kind of get caught back up or to start that process. So this is good news. There's sort of a related article, one that's, I don't know, maybe not quite so optimistic from Kansas.com, the Wichita Eagle. This is another story by Molly McMillan, a past guest on the show. Aviation analyst sees slow growth in business jet market. And this is from some comments made by Roland Vincent of Roland Vincent Associates, and these were given at the Wichita Aero Club lunch. And while he sees the forecast for business jets to be pretty healthy over the next 10 years, Max, it's an interesting breakout by sort of size of business jet.
Yes, that's the most telling thing about that, isn't it? They've broken it out into about six different categories, and the highest growth by far is for the largest and farthest flying jets, and the worst growth is for the smallest, tiniest jets. So, once again, it seems like the high end of the market is looking like the best. And I think we see that in all kinds of other parts of the economy as well.
Yeah, Vincent is looking at 9,391 business jets, again, over the next 10 years, valued at $257 billion. But he offered some reasons why the recovery for business aviation hasn't been quite so robust. He notes that while buyers in this segment have cash, they're very risk adverse. So coming out of the recession, apparently, could afford it, but people have been leery to spend the money on these kind of jets, and I can understand that. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's only when you've got a little surplus cash you start to think about acquiring new aircraft. So, I mean, to tie the two stories together, one says that utilization is up, which means the jets people are flying more, and the other says, well, you know, the pickup in sales of new jets might not be quite as fast as the manufacturers would have liked to have seen.
That's right. That's right. Another item they talk about is how there's been an oversupply of used light and mid-sized jets. So that would obviously impact sale of new aircraft in that size class.
And those jets are getting cheaper and cheaper, too.
So, yeah.
Which is unfortunate for the people that have been holding on to them.
Kathy, have you ever flown a jet, or has your experience been the strictly piston?
I am strictly piston, and actually mostly little pistons.
Tell us about some of the airplanes that you've been flying.
Well, back many years ago, I soloed in a Cherokee 140. And as an instructor, I mostly instructed in Cessnas. I did have one person who I taught in a Piper Navajo and a Cessna. Was it a 341? It's been a while. Is that what it is? A 341? It's a twin turbo. Actually, he was a Navy guy. Had his name on his window, you know, Captain, whatever the name is, it was. It was kind of funny. Everybody made fun of it behind his back at the airport. But I got to fly with him, and he was a pretty good pilot, to tell you the truth.
Was his call sign in parentheses in the sign there? Because a lot of pilots will have, you know, their nickname, you know, Top Gun or whatever it is, in parentheses or in quote marks.
No, he just had his captain name. It was kind of like, again, I enjoyed flying with him, but most of the time was 172s. My favorite airplane to fly is a P210. That's my favorite. That's the one I've made the best landing in my whole life. But most of my time is in 172s and 152s.
Okay, good. All right, let's go on to our next item. This is, let's see, who is this from? What's AL.com? Alabama.
Oh, exactly. It's a newspaper down in Alabama.
This is like the Birmingham paper, right? NTSB bans airline and pilots union from participating in UPS 1354 crash investigation. That's an interesting headline. Usually we think of the NTSB as embracing the other parties that have an interest or some involvement in a crash investigation. Max T, what's going on here?
Well, you're right. It is unusual for them to be excluding parties from an investigation. But the interesting part is those parties have already been involved, for a long time in this investigation. And the investigation itself, it is, in fact, supposed to wind up literally within the next month or so. And what they're really saying is, oh, sorry, guys, you broke the rules. We're no longer going to let you contribute to this investigation, which, by the way, is all just about over anyway. So, it's not going to have a whole lot of impact. But what's interesting is the story itself behind the crash. The crash occurred last August, so just a year ago, and it was a UPS A300 from Louisville to Birmingham, just slightly over a one-hour flight, and it arrived at 4:47 in the morning in Birmingham, but unfortunately it arrived just short of the runway 18, and both pilots were killed in the crash. And the reason that the pilots' union and UPS have been banned is that both have made public statements about their views on the cause of the crash. So the cockpit recorder was fascinating. The pilots' union said that rarely do the pilots get to speak from the grave as to what the cause of the flight was, but in this case, they quoted the flight recorder in which the co-pilot had said she had gotten a good sleep but was so tired. And also, just before the flight, the captain had told a friend that he was tired and these schedules are killing me. So it was really pretty sad. During the flight, there was a long conversation the two had about the new rules, which were to take effect the following month, which would give airline pilots two extra hours of rest time. But there's what they called a carve-out. The carve-out was an exception, which meant that cargo pilots like UPS and FedEx wouldn't get any additional sleep. And they were talking about how sad it was because they thought that pilots should get just as much sleep, whether they're flying cargo or whether they're flying passengers.
Yeah, sure. I don't think the what's behind you in the plane should be the determining factor.
No, and the crash is very eerily similar to a crash in Tallahassee that occurred back in 2002 with a FedEx 727, which also came up short of the runway. In that case, it was runway 9, also in the morning hours when it was very dark. And in both cases, both of those runways did not have instrument approaches with vertical guidance, so they didn't have an ILS or a WASS-type GPS approach, which meant that to stay on the glide slope, they would have to visually look at the visual glide slope indicator, which you certainly can't see as far out as you can with the electronic glide slope that you would have for the other runways. Hmm. And so some of the other airlines had actually forbidden their pilots from using that particular runway at that particular airport. There have been a lot of lawsuits that have occurred since then. The co-pilot's widower, her husband, has sued Honeywell, saying that the first warning from the ground proximity system came off 1 second after they hit the tree.
Oh, it's an interesting story. I mean, usually you want to wait until the NTSB releases its investigation results before commenting on an investigation. So I can understand their dismay.
Exactly. And the NTSB actually commented and said that the reason they forbid people from releasing their own statements is that not only does it tend to taint the public view of it, but it also makes it harder in the future for these parties to work together because it creates a certain amount of antagonism among them.
Sure. Okay. All right, our next item is kind of interesting. This kind of relates to the Sony PlayStation. You might ask, well, what does that have to do with aviation, particularly with an outage that the Sony PlayStation recently had, which I guess left a lot of gamers stranded for a period of time. But Max T., what's the aviation connection here?
This is a bizarre story, absolutely bizarre. And by the way, I have a very, very indirect connection. When I used to work for a Hewlett-Packard on the sales side of the house, one of my customers was Sony PlayStation, which is headquartered, at least at that time, in Foster City, which is just a short drive up the road here from Silicon Valley in California. But I think everyone is familiar with hacker groups like Anonymous, which have gone out to attack the websites of people or organizations that they're unhappy with. And some group, and I'm not saying it was Anonymous, some group of hackers apparently has been unhappy with Sony PlayStation's network and some other networks as well. And so they had been actually doing a denial of service attacks on those websites where they use, for example, 1,000 different zombie computers to try and access the website simultaneously, essentially making it impossible for real customers to access the website. So, I mean, this is just all kind of part and parcel of the normal internet, malfeasance that goes on these days. But what makes this really fascinating is these people took it one step further. They started tweeting on Twitter that there was a bomb aboard a flight in which the Sony PlayStation president was traveling, a commercial flight. And so you just got, I mean, talk about crossing a line. That's so far beyond the line. It's quite unthinkable that someone was that out to lunch that they would do that.
Yes. Yeah. These things are usually fairly anonymous. Is there any chance that the people responsible for doing this are going to be found?
Oh, I think so. In fact, there was one comment from the executive that we'd leave it up to the Justice Department to track these folks down, and I suspect that's happening. I mean, that's just that's got to be a violation of multiple federal laws.
Sure.
Yep, I would imagine those folks are headed for deep cover right now, trying to cover their tracks. They probably now realize that they shouldn't have done that.
Well, I hope so. And yeah, I mean, there has to be a follow through because we certainly don't want this to be a precedent for other folks who look at this and say, hey, this is a great way to make a point, whatever it is. and engage in this sort of stuff. We just, you know, God, we can't have that.
Yeah, I mean, the airliner was diverted to another city as the police investigated the threat, and obviously they had to do that because who knows whether the threat was credible or not. But that would be highly disruptive to aviation around the world if we have copycats starting to do those kind of things.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, sometimes things that are new are really things that are old. And we have a story about Eastern Airlines. Everyone probably is aware of the old Eastern, which went out of business back in 1991. I remember flying on Eastern Airlines well before that. I think it was one of the first airlines, maybe not the first, but one of the first airlines I ever flew on. Remember the Eastern Shuttle, you know, up and down the East Coast there.
Absolutely. I think we all flew that a few times.
Yeah, it was great. It was kind of a unique thing. It was almost like a like a train service in that, you know, you could just show up. I think, wasn't it like a flight every half hour or something like that? There was a real frequent schedule.
I think it was hourly. And then I think ultimately U.S. Air, as I recall, acquired Eastern. And then they took over the shuttle and over time started cutting back on it. But yes, that was really convenient. Well, there were three locations, wasn't it? Washington, New York, and Boston?
In Boston, yes. I think so. So they went out of business in 1991. And then there was something called Eastern Airlines Group. They got created in 2011. And they bought or acquired the old Eastern Airlines intellectual property. So they've got the logo. They've got, you know, kind of the name. I guess they've got it all. And just recently, they moved their head offices to Miami International Airport. In fact, according to this article in Motley Fool, to the same operations center, the same building that the old Eastern Airlines used. And they're planning on making a go of it. They have some Boeing 737-800s on order. I think the article points out 10 firm and 10 options. And they've recently filed an application for what's called a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity, which is an interesting title. And that is followed later by a certification from the FAA. And they're planning on making a go of it. I don't know. Max, what do you think? Do you think the old Eastern brand still has some value?
Wow, I was just thinking that was Frank Borman's airline. Now, I kid about his airline. He was actually the president after he finished his career as an astronaut at NASA. I like the Eastern brand. I think we all have a certain fondness for it, for those of us that flew on it years and years ago. I just kind of look at the statistics and say, you know, the odds are not great these days on surviving as an airline with, you know, hundreds of airlines being created and very few of them surviving. So if anything, my prediction, if I can make one, is that it will someday be assimilated into some other airline.
And maybe that's the play that the investors are going for. I don't know. I'm just, you know, speculating wildly without any kind of information. And in fact, I don't even know who the investors are. I didn't spend hours trying to find out, but I did spend some time, and I didn't really find much information.
Interesting. Hey, by the way, do you know what one of the shortest flights in Eastern's schedule used to be?
What?
I flew an Eastern flight when I was a teenager from Miami to, get this, Fort Lauderdale. It was hilarious. It was at night. We were just barely above the radio towers below us. I mean, it must have flown at 5,000 feet. And the airline, the flight attendants were joking with us, and they said, "Well, good thing you don't smoke, because," they said, you know, the no smoking sign was out for no more than 5 minutes. It was just take off, you're in cruise, and land. Now, I had not booked that particular flight, but I was with a group that was coming back from from Ecuador, and we were supposed to fly from Miami to Pennsylvania, and unfortunately we missed our flight for whatever reason, and so they rebooked us on this little flight, so we'd be positioned the next day for our actual flight out of Fort Lauderdale. So the flight was, as you might guess, almost empty.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the days when we used to be able to smoke on the airplane. I remember doing that myself back in long time ago when I used to smoke. Yeah, I just can't even imagine doing that. But
well, in the tough thing for non-smokers was when they split the airplane, because if you happen to be in the last row of the non-smokers,
yeah.
It was like being in the smoking section yourself. So yeah. I'm really happy we have non-smoking flights these days.
Same here. All right, well, we're talking with Kathy Babbas. Kathy, you have such an interesting background. At one time, you had actually tried to go the route of becoming a helicopter pilot, I think, right?
I was, as a teenager, actually graduated from high school. I was working at an FBO, and I was the girl behind the counter who schedules students with instructors called the gas truck. And I saw these guys flying, and they would have a bill for $1,000, and they'd give me a $100 bill and say, I'm paid in full. And I went, how does that happen? And they said, well, let's call the GI Bill. I said, how do I get that? And they said, you have to join the service. So I did. I joined the Army, and I did want to be a helicopter pilot, but at that time, they were not accepting women into the program. So they said, well, you can't be a helicopter pilot, but you could be an air traffic controller if you get a high enough score. And I did. And so for the next 6 years of my life, I was an air traffic controller in the Army.
And you, when you came out of the Army, didn't you continue that in the commercial world?
Well, I actually, while I was in the Army, I did use the GI Bill to get most of my flight ratings. And you know, commercial flight instructor, instrument instructor, multi-engine. And when I got out, I became a full-time flight instructor out of Torrance Airport in Los Angeles area. And then when the strike happened and President Reagan fired all those people, well, that was an opportunity for me. And I actually got to be an air traffic controller at Torrance Airport.
And that was maybe... Was that around the time Rob Mark was also an air traffic controller? I think it. I can't remember if he was pre-Reagan or post-Reagan.
That's a touchy topic for those who were pre. If they run into one of us who were post.
No. Now Rob was actually pre-radar. I think that's when he was an air traffic controller.
No. Yeah, I think he was post. I think he was post-Reagan. But it's interesting how you essentially financed, Kathy, your flight instruction. I mean, you had some scholarships even before the Army, didn't you, that kind of got you started?
I did. When I was 13, I joined the Civil Air Patrol because a girlfriend at school invited me to a meeting. And in Civil Air Patrol, I don't know if you've ever discussed that on the show, but it's Civil Air Patrol holds a search and rescue responsibility for the United States, for the continental United States, and it's coordinated through the Air Force. And Civil Air Patrol cadets gain their rank by taking tests based on topics that will let them take and pass their private pilot written. So, you know, to be an airman, you learn about the forces of flight, and then the next time you might learn about engine operations, and it goes on from there. And so I had progressed and applied for a scholarship where I had to pay one third and then two thirds were paid to get my solo. And then a year later, I competed again for a national scholarship, and they sent 21 of us to Oklahoma State University and in Stillwater, Oklahoma. And we flew twice a day and once on Sundays till we all had our private pilot licenses.
Oh, wow. And so you did that as a group?
It was an Airbus. They were all together in it.
Well, we lived in Oklahoma State dormitories, and there were instructors. And, you know, some people flew in the morning and some people flew in the afternoon. And you know, the schedule was very tight. And we had ground school. We had to all have a current solo and our writtens passed before we got there. So it was just a matter of doing all the dual cross countries. And we had... Did I say current solo? We had to have a current solo, 90-day solo.
Were the folks who were going through that program, was there a variety of different motivations for learning to fly across them? And you know, and later on in your experience as a flight instructor, do you still find the same motivations or have things changed over time?
Well, most of the kids in Civil Air Patrol you know, they joined CAP because they liked aviation, and it was just a wonderful experience. There were people from all over the country from ages 16 to 21, because once you hit 22, you're not a cadet anymore. You become what's called a senior member. But what I found when I was instructing, and I haven't really instructed recently, was, I mean, I taught housewives, I taught engineers, I taught a 16-year-old cheerleader, and actually I got, she didn't want to. Her father even bought her an airplane to learn to fly in. Wow. And I actually convinced her father that it's best not to make a girl fly if she really doesn't want to. I think flying, you know, there's such an effort involved and so much that you need to learn and process that if you're not into it, you probably shouldn't be doing it.
Totally agree. I've had some kids that have come to me where, yep, dad always wanted to be a pilot. And, oh, those folks are, you know, they're not as fun to teach because, you know, the parents are wasting their money. And as a flight instructor, do you get satisfaction out of watching your people succeed?
Oh, absolutely. I have several of my students that did go on, and they're airline pilots now. Yeah. But my life took a different turn.
Well, probably for the better, because if you were doing an airline pilot, you might be on furlough right now.
Well, actually, at our agency, we have hired in the past a lot of pilots on furlough, and when American called them back, we lost a lot of most excellent people. Hmm. And we are now again in a hiring phase, and if anybody wants to go to www.nga, that's NEMA. Our novembergolfalpha.mil, like for military. You can poke around at the careers. I would encourage you to go into what's called, it's like a collection resume. And that's, you don't have a really good chance from getting hired out of there, but just keep looking back. And when they have one that says aeronautical analyst or aeronautical intelligence, go for it and put your resume in. Now, that's only if you pretty much have lost the dream. You don't want to fly anymore. But we have actually a lot of people there that fly on the side, that instruct on the side, charter on the side. So, you know, they're able to maintain that because we're government workers and we accrue leave and they just use their leave to go do something else more fun.
So let's talk about the NGA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, a little bit. So these positions that are available, what kinds of people is the NGA looking for? What kinds of backgrounds or interests, skill sets?
Well, for the aeronautical ones, they require a commercial pilot license, 250 hours. But there's a whole lot of ors. Like you could have a degree or this experience. You don't have to have the commercial pilot certificate with 250 hours if you have a bachelor's degree from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University.
Hmm.
And then there's certain also just experience doing this job. Some people from within NGA have transitioned from something totally not aeronautical, but they get on the job training and they become aeronautical analysts.
Does everybody work where you are? In other words, you told us earlier that you're in the St. Louis area. Is that where all of these jobs are located, or are they, can you do this from home?
You can't do it from home, but 98% of all aeronautical personnel at NGA are in St. Louis because that's the only place we have the special computers and the software that makes all of the books and the charts. Now, we don't physically print those charts. That goes out to a contractor, but we have to have all the software that will make our data turn into something usable for the people who do print the books and charts. You know, we have two people in Washington, D.C., and we have one person that I know of over in England. So pretty much if you're in the aeronautical department at NGA, you're going to live in St. Louis.
So are you making what the military pilots would call the flips, the charts?
Absolutely. That's what we make. We make the flip.
And can you tell us what FLIP stands for?
FLIP stands for Flight Information Publication. Okay. And, you know, foreign countries also have FLIP. Every foreign country that's a member of ICAO, International Civil Aviation Organization, produces a form of their flip. And what we do is we either subscribe to it, or we trade for it, or we exchange. We say, we'll give you ours if you give us yours. And that's how we get all the data for all the countries.
And I never knew for sure, is flip just the private pilots would think of as the instrument approach plates, or is it more than that?
It's more than that. It's what private pilots would call the NACO charts,
okay,
the instrument flying charts, and the airport facility directory. We call that our en route supplements. And then the other thing you said, the instrument approach procedures.
Oh, and I don't know the new name, but it's no longer NACO charts. The FAA has changed the name of that division again.
Again?
Exactly.
I used to be in the U.S. branch, but I haven't been in there since January, so they must have done that since January.
Yeah, but it's a new enough name. Nobody knows what it is. So they're not telling anyone.
Oh, well.
Hey, Max, I'm just kind of curious. I think talking with a lady with the .mil email address is pretty cool. What do you think?
It's very cool.
I like that.
Yeah, we don't encounter that too often. Kathy, what drove you? motivated you to go towards the NGA?
Well, that's interesting too. I was very broke, very single, mom of two little kids, and I was at an unemployment office somewhere in Illinois, and stuck to the wall was this announcement, and I'm reading it, you know, you could be a flight instructor, commercial pilot, Embry-Riddle, and I'd already graduated from Embry-Riddle, and I'm looking at all these things, and I'm like, I can do all that. So I applied, but I applied in 1993, and if you know about St. Louis, 1993 was the year of the Great Flood, where the Mississippi and the Missouri flooded for miles, and so they stopped hiring. As a matter of fact, the aeronautical department was in a different building a few miles south of the main building, and it was totally underwater. So they had to, you know, move everything. Anyway, short version, they didn't hire for a few years. And by a few years, I didn't get to NGA until 1998.
Well, yeah, that was a delay.
But it does take the biggest problem with the hiring process is that you have to undergo a top secret security investigation. And depending on your background, and mine was wide and colorful, the more people they have to talk to, the longer it's going to take. So my security investigation took 2 years. That is not typical.
Wow.
It's typical to be 3 to 6 months. Three months to 6 months for like somebody fresh out of college who doesn't have too much of a history.
Kathy, I got bad news for you. The history of the show has been anyone with top secret clearance after they talk to us, they lose it.
Okay. Well, the other thing that listeners do need to know is to work for us, because we are an intelligence agency, you do have to be a U.S. citizen.
Ah, yes, of course.
And you have to have some intelligence, right?
Supposedly.
Well, if it's called an intelligence agency, you'd think that's a prerequisite.
It's a great place to work. I've loved working there. So I'm going on my 16th year now. And it's, wow. You know, if you want an aviation job where you get to think about aviation and keeping pilots safe, supporting our war fighters, you know, all the time while you're at work, this is the job to have. And you get to be home on the weekends. You get federal holidays off. It's awesome.
Great.
You're selling me. I think I'm going to apply.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like fun.
It is.
And we'll put the link in the show notes where folks can go to learn more about those kind of opportunities. Kathy, someone who's been flying and instructing, for as long as you have, always has some good stories. And I wanted to ask you if you had, any in particular that you could share with our audience that they might find interesting.
Oh, let's see. You know, I always like to tell a story with a point. I was a brand new private pilot. And I decided for spring break to go visit my uncle in Tallahassee, Florida. He happened to be a designated pilot examiner. And when I arrived at his house, I see, oh my gosh, New York plates in the driveway. That can only be cousins. And I really didn't want to meet New York family, but oh well. Well, it turns out they were two cousins my age. And my uncle says, hey, why don't you guys fly to Dog Island? I'll check you out in my plane tomorrow. And like I said, I'm a pretty fresh private pilot at this point. So Uncle Bob and I go out to the airport, get in his airplane, and I had never been in a 172. The biggest plane I'd been in, it was a 150. And so we went out, we did some air work, and we came back into the pattern. And so I entered the pattern, I came around on final. I realized a mile out, there's just no way I'm getting this airplane on the ground. And I looked at him and I said, we have to go around now. So we went around. And I came around again, we got clear to land again. And I said, and I was a little lower and a little slower. But I said, no, we're still not going to make it. And so we went around again. And the third time we landed, it was a little firm, but it was a decent landing. Mm-hmm. And I said, are we going to take off again? And he says, no, we're just going to taxi back to the hangar. And he says, I'm going to sign you off, Kathy, and let me tell you why. He says, because there was a lot of pressure for you to try to make it get on the ground with me as an examiner and your uncle and all. He says, I know that you will make the right decision and not break my airplane. And
that's good.
Yeah.
That really is it's a story with a point. Now you want to hear a story with no point?
Well, I don't think that would fit in this podcast. Oh, wait. No, it might. Go right ahead.
Well, the story with no point is I had an interesting meeting with Steve McQueen.
Oh,
the Steve McQueen?
The Steve McQueen.
Wow.
And was that? Hmm? And was his wife there? Was it Allie? McGraw?
No, it was the next one after Allie.
Oh, okay.
But that looked just like her.
Oh, okay.
Well, anyway, I had just finished my 6 days as a flight instructor, and I was really looking forward to my next day off. End of the day, in walks this guy that looks like he just fell off a painter truck. And he's got his girlfriend with him who is dressed like a hippie, no bra, flip-flops. And he says, I'd like to get a little duel. And I'm thinking, okay, he knows some language. He says, I said, I'm getting ready to get off, but I guess I could take you up. So we're talking, and I said, well, you know, if you want dual, I said, have you flown before? And he goes, yeah, I got a couple thousand hours. And I'm thinking, okay, you got your logbook? No, I lost it. Oh, right. Lost logbook. Yeah, got it. And so he says, I quit flying about 10 years ago. And I go, oh, why? And he says, well, because I got into drugs. And I said, well, that's a good reason. I'm glad you quit flying 10 years ago. He says, but now I'm out of it, and I just want to see if I can fly again. I said, okay. So a girlfriend gets in the back, and we take off. He does a nice job. He runs the checklist. He does everything. We get down. And I said, well, you know, I'd like to log this for you. Let me give you one of these little paper log books. And I sign it, and I give it to him, and he goes, how do you pronounce your last name? And I said, Babas. He said, do you have any relatives in Tallahassee, Florida? See, this even relates to the other. And I said, yeah, my Uncle Bob. And then he proceeded to tell me the name of his wife and his three children.
Oh, wow.
And I said, how do you know that? He said, because that's how I got all my time delivering airplanes for your uncle.
Golly.
So that night, I called my uncle and I said, I got this character here. Can you tell me about how many hours you think he has? And he kind of matched what the other guy said. But so that was the next morning. But that day he says, well, now I'd like a dual cross country tomorrow to Santa Paula Airport. And I'm like, oh, unofficial charter. Statute of limitations is up, I think. And I said, I'll tell you what. I said, if you want to do a dual cross country, he said, you'll get to meet Steve McQueen. I was going to say no. And then I said, oh, okay, I'll go meet Steve McQueen. And so I said, if you're going to do it, you have to plan the whole thing. You know, I'll be there. So he plans it. He comes. He's prepared. And we go to Santa Paula Airport. I said, the one thing you don't get to do is land at Santa Paula Airport because Max West, if you've been there, you know that it's surrounded by mountains and there's no horizon. And there's all kinds of landing optical illusions that can just mess you up. And so he agreed to that. And so we landed, taxied up to Steve McQueen's hangar that had two steermen in it and some other airplane that I don't remember. Hmm. And Steve McQueen and his girlfriend were living on a mattress with no sheets on it, just a mattress and a refrigerator and a microwave in the hangar where the airplanes were. And this guy was the interior decorator he had hired to rehab the house that they had just bought near the airport. So we hop into four of us in an MG, which you know is made for two, and Steve McQueen alone in his blue F-150 faded blue truck with a mysterious streak down the side. And so as we're following him to this house, I found out what the streak was. He chewed tobacco.
Oh, no.
But anyway, so the interior decorator did his, we're going to blast this out and we're going to change this room and we're going to do this color. And McQueen says, yeah, make it happen. And then we went back to the airport. But we did find out that McQueen had his first solo in a steerman.
Hmm. Lucky guy.
That is. Wow.
Well, it's funny. There's a whole generation of servicemen who had their first solos in a steerman back in... that's true. Yeah, I was the primary training aircraft back in the late 30s.
Hey, Kathy, I noticed that you have your biography up on Linda Meek's Girls with Wings site. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us just really briefly about that? And we've had Linda on the show before a couple of times, actually, I think. But maybe just kind of refresh our listeners' minds or for those who are new to the show, talk a little bit about that organization. What do you think it means?
Well, Girls with Wings is designed to encourage young girls to consider a career in aviation. And Linda has put 10 years of her heart and soul into this. And to tell you the truth, I said, you know, since Brian, your producer, found me on Girls with Wings, you know, I said, you know, I'd be happy to plug you. And she says, oh, it's going to go away. She says, I'm just don't have the energy to do it anymore. But it's still out there. And one of the cool features is they have a mentor spot. And me being one of them, but several other women that are pilots, mechanics, air traffic controllers, many different careers in airplane sales, and everybody put their little biography up there, and then girls could contact you with a question if they wanted to know something about what it is that you did or how you ended up being what you were. And then she also wrote a book. I think it's called Penelope Pilot. I know Penelope's in the name.
Yeah, Penelope, yeah.
And I have met Linda at Air Venture a few years ago. And, you know, she's just done everything she could. And she told me she's going to be closing the website down. I hate to say that.
Oh, I hate to hear that. That's... I don't want to hear that. I don't want to accept that. She's done so much great work, and all the people associated with Girls with Wings have done such a, I think, an important job.
At full disclosure, we're pals. She and I had dinner in all places, Elmira, New York, last year, just before she took her job with Cathay Pacific. So she's now out.
Yes,
probably said that wrong. Out in Hong Kong, where she's been for just slightly over a year. But yeah. Outstanding lady, and I think we all understand that if you work on a particular project, you know, long enough, it's like, it's kind of fun to move on to something else. So I support her in that, and she's done great work.
Yeah, I'm sad to see it go because I like the website, and it's kind of fun to go to, especially if you have a young woman that you're trying to inspire.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, Kathy, it's been a great conversation. We could probably talk for a long time. I want to mention, though, about your stand-up work. Is that just like a completely different life that you lead?
It is. I started in September 2010. I went to the Funny Bone. They had an open mic. I did my 4 minutes, and people laughed, and I was hooked.
That's awesome.
That is awesome. And you have a website where folks can actually look at some of the clips from some performances.
Yeah, I have three clips up. I only put up clean clips because I view the web as family friendly, or at least my website is family friendly. And if you want to hear the dirty stuff, you have to come to a show.
When's the next show?
Well, you also have to come to St. Louis, although I did perform at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles in April of a year ago.
Oh.
So, yeah, it was.
That's where Jay Leno and all those guys started, right?
Damon Wayans was there at that time, and it was very exciting to perform at the Comedy Store.
And that big question, you didn't find any new material here in this hour talking with us, did you? Because I'm worried.
Probably not.
You and I
don't know if that's good or bad.
Well, I'm not sure I want to be a joke, so.
I know I'm a joke, so.
Well, I do have my comedy website. It's pretty easy, KathyBabbas.com, and I say that's Kathy with a C, babies no E. That's how you spell my last name, B-A-B-I-S.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us on the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really appreciate it. Had a great conversation. And we'll put a link in the show notes, as I mentioned, to your website, but also the NGA website where folks can go either learn more about that, or if they're interested in pursuing career opportunities there, they can find that information as well. So, Kathy, thanks again.
Okay, and the comedy website has a contact form on it. So if you fill that out and say you heard me on Airplane Geeks, it'll send me an email, and then I'll get back to you if you have more questions about careers at NGA.
Oh, very good. Thank you so much. And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hi, I'm Pete Combs, and if your business is flying, then you'll want to check out NBAA's Flight Plan. Whether you're flight crew, cabin crew, line crew, or maintenance, NBAA's Flight Plan is 5 minutes well spent on topics that range from safety to education to procedures both new and old. You'll find us on Apple's iTunes website or at the home of business aviation, nbaa.org.
Thanks, Pete. All right, coming up now, we've got Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment. Let me just preface it by saying that he actually produced a segment for last week, but I don't know exactly what happened, but somehow it didn't get to the right place, or we didn't see it in the right place or something. And so even though he had it, we didn't include it. So Peter brings us that segment now. I think he's sort of added a little bit to it. And so here's Peter Across the Pond.
I'm really sorry that last week's segment didn't come through and get into the program. I had recorded a segment which covered some news on the Vulcan and the two Lancasters. So here it is. After last week's mentions, I could not leave without a brief report of two amazing aircraft. Let's start off then with the Avro Lancaster. Friday the 8th of August saw the arrival of the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum's Avro Lancaster, nicknamed Vera, into the UK. It's called Vera because of its markings, Victor Romeo Alpha. It had just made the epic 3,700-mile crossing over the Atlantic from its base in Ontario, Canada. The aircraft, a Mark 10, has now joined the only other airworthy Lancaster flown by the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. Now, this aircraft has been seen many times flying across the UK at air shows, memorials and events, and this model is a Lancaster Mark III. Now, they've gained their public display authorisation earlier this week, and they now embark upon a 50-show joint display accompanied by the other Merlin-powered Battle of Britain Memorial Flight fighters, the Spitfire and the Hurricane. The display is sponsored by a beer company and is called the Thwaites Lancaster Bomber Tour 2014. We'll see this once-in-a-lifetime display. And for those lucky enough over here in the UK to see it, they get to soak up the sound of all those gorgeous Merlin engines. This from the BBC.
A moment in aviation history. This, the first time Lancasters have flown in formation here for more than 50 years.
To see these two together is just unbelievable.
That was absolutely fantastic, and to be this close to them as well, it's amazing, really.
Just sends shivers up your spine, really does, and it's just a truly amazing sight.
But this flight was due to happen last week when the Canadian Lancaster arrived in Lincolnshire. Bad weather, though, meant it had to land at RAF Coningsby alone last Friday. Today, though, the last two airworthy Lancasters in the world were finally able to fly together.
These are difficult aircraft to fly in formation with one another, especially on a breezy day like today. They're inclined to be blown around a lot. The poor pilots have got to work extremely hard to keep the aircraft in the correct position relative to one another.
Watching today's historic flight, Stan Instone, a Lancaster engineer during the Second World War.
When I heard the engines and those flew over, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up, you know, and I felt a shivery sort of sensation, actually. Because it's a long, long time since I actually flew in a Lancaster, a long time. And it brought back a lot of memories, actually.
After a short wait, it was time for another test flight and another chance to see these two aircraft together in the skies above Lincolnshire.
Now, the second aircraft discussed last week was XH-558. That, of course, is the last fly-in Avro Vulcan. Now, we saw this aircraft at Yeovilton last month, and it was by far the most popular aircraft, both on the ground and in the air. The challenge that the team have is that, having retired from RAF service in 1993, it was lovingly but very painfully, from a resource perspective, returned to flight. Both spares and money are running out, though. Last year, she had a terrible engine failure as a result of FOD ingestion. Unfortunately, it may be that after this season, and possibly some flying into 2015, the Spirit of Great Britain, as she's called, will no longer grace our skies. The aircraft and the team at the Vulcan to the Sky Trust rely 100% on charitable donations and support. If they don't get enough resources to sustain her, then she will be confined to the ground. Me, for one, has been very blessed in having seen her display many times. I never tire of her. She's just very, very impressive. It's sad, though, that our children will only now see her in the ground. If you can help her, go to their webpage. It's vulcantothesky.org. Let's just hear her one more time. Unfortunately, having an extra week, I've been able to add a little bit of an update to both of those stories in the journey of the two Lancasters accompanying the Vulcan bomber on a flight. If you're following this on social media or followed it on social media, hashtag Avro Three Sisters, you will see some fantastic photographs. As I sit here recording this now, they are crewing up to make this historic flight of seeing those three wonderful Avro aircraft in the air together. What an amazing feat. So this has given me the opportunity to add this little bit to the end of the segment, and apologies again, it didn't get into last week's. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
You know, I think it's so important that we preserve these kind of historic aircraft. I mean, in preferably in flying condition, you know. I mean, it's nice to be able to see them in a museum, well-preserved. But, you know, there's just nothing like seeing one of these things flying through the air. It's so important, I think.
It is wonderful. You know, the argument I think people make is, you know, by flying them, we're going to eventually lose them through crashes and things like that. So that's the only side where I say, wait a minute, we don't want to lose the last one of, you know, whatever form of aircraft it is.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point, Max. When it gets down to a small number of them, the risk of not having anything left is kind of significant. But yeah. Kathy, do you get to air shows or events like this from time to time?
Well, I live near Scott Air Force Base, and so we do have air shows out at Scott, and then we also have air shows in St. Louis out at the Spirit Airport, a little bit west of the city, and we've had some really nice displays there. Of course, Air Venture is always nice to go to.
Yeah, are you a regular at Air Venture?
I've been twice. I camped once and hoteled once. And the camping was in the rain, and I still preferred it to the hotel.
Really? Well, tell us, why is that?
It's the camaraderie.
Yes.
It's, well, you know, you want to get back to your hotel so you don't stick around and see the movie that they're showing on the giant blow-up screen in the camping area. And you know, you get to meet more people. Otherwise, you're just stuck with the people at your hotel, which by and large are people that are going to Air Venture, but there's a much bigger crowd of people. Hmm. And there was one guy that had one of those hanging tents that he lived in. It was, have you ever seen one of those hanging tents?
Hanging tents?
It hangs from a branch on the tree, and then he sleeps in it that way.
No, I haven't seen that.
You can Google it.
I only know it. Well, I know the sort of, I don't know if it's the equivalent or the same thing that rock climbers might use sometimes on a really long climb where you may not make it all the way up, and so you sort of
hang out,
yeah, on the side of the cliff. This must be something a little bit different than that.
I just remember it was very interesting. But, you know, and I also was camping with my brother and his family, and I'm not really a camper.
You know, the thing I love about camping at Oshkosh, it's I mean, you're absolutely right about that. The outdoor theater, that is just fun to be out there on a nice, cool night with hundreds of other people just, you know, watching whatever movie they're showing. But at night, I find it's fun just to walk the flight line. You know, there are times when you'll walk through any parts you want, whether it's the military aircraft that had guards during the day. And at night, hey, it's just you and, you know, Uncle Sam's Hardware or, you know, Long Rose of Stearman's or P-51s, and there's just something magical about walking you know, along the flight line there after it's in, you know, the sun has gone down and it's nice and cool. It's you feel more intimate with the show if you're actually camping there and you know, rising with the sun and, you know, going to sleep with the airplanes at night.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's kind of a full immersion kind of a experience, I guess.
Yep.
Well, one of my bosses, he had a J-2 Cub, and he won the best restoration two years ago.
Wow. That's pretty significant.
Yeah, he spent years getting that ready, and he just retired. And so, but he was my direct supervisor, and a lot of people there, you know, where I work, own planes, love planes, live for planes. You know, it's great.
And you're a lot closer to Oshkosh than either of us as well, which is nice.
It's nice.
True. I think it's only about a 8-hour drive, not counting traffic.
Sure. Very doable. All right. Now we have a listener recording. This came from Micah. You've heard Micah send in some recordings in the past. This one is called Pueblo, A Geek's Dream. So why don't we listen to Micah?
It was 30 years ago that I first stepped foot in Pueblo, Colorado. Little did I know that it was going to be an airplane geek's dream from the moment I arrived to the day I left. I had traveled to Pueblo to interview for a job. Flying from Columbus, Ohio, I switched planes in Denver's Stapleton Airport and was already delighted when I found myself climbing on board a Dash 6 Twin Otter for the flight to Pueblo. Aircraft types were not available on the handwritten tickets that were issued in those days, so the Twin Otter was a pleasant surprise. When I arrived at the Pueblo Memorial Airport late in the afternoon, I didn't know it was the home of the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum. In 1984, there was no internet search. When you wanted to research something, you used an encyclopedia, or if you had access to a good library, a periodical index for more recent literature. Information was not available at one's fingertips like it is today. Three people from the selection committee met me at the Pueblo Airport. We had completed our perfunctory introductions and formalities as I waited for my bag. We walked to the car, loaded it with my bag, and we all climbed in. As we started driving down the airport road, imagine their surprise when I uncontrollably exclaimed, "Oh my God, that's an A-26!" On static display, on our right side, nose to the road, was a Douglas A-26 Invader. I had never seen one before other than in pictures, but I recognized it right away. It was beautiful, and I just couldn't control myself when I saw it. I assume I just thrown the interview, but on the bright side, I got to see an A-26. After a very brief silence in the car that seemed like it lasted hours to me, I managed to explain how aircraft had always been a major interest of mine, and that the sight of my first A-26 Invader was a slightly overwhelming surprise. All seemed as good as it could be after that, and we headed off to dinner. I was in Pueblo overnight and had an all-day interview scheduled for the next day. Because of some last-minute changes, though, I ended up back at the airport a couple of hours early. The interview committee member who dropped me off apologized for having to leave me to wait alone for my flight. I was fine with it, though. More than fine, in fact. But as usual, I managed to say not quite the right thing. I was cool, calm, suave, and professional. Just like when I arrived, and before I knew it, I found myself saying, "It's fine. I'll just go visit the museum. That way at least the trip won't be wasted if I don't get the job." Well, it can't say much for the other three candidates that they interviewed, because I got offered the job after all that, and I moved to Pueblo. I was there for 3 hard years, but on the bright side, it was an airplane geek's dream in many ways. Why an airplane geek's dream? Well, let me start by telling you a bit about the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum. In 1984, the museum was simply a large group of static, perhaps non-restorable aircraft displays. It was surrounded by a gated fence that, as far as I know, was never closed, and there was never an attendant or docent nearby. Perhaps the best way to describe it was an airplane geek's playground, and for me it truly was. I was able to climb through the bomb bays of the B-47 and B-29. I was able to open the cowling of the Sikorsky H-34 Seahorse, and while the engine was gone, even with the rotors tied down, I was able to turn the transmission enough to move them. Now understand that I was very careful never to do anything that might possibly damage those beautiful aircraft. No matter how much I wanted to, I did not force my way into any cockpits or fuselages. You can imagine how hard it was to resist. Who of any of us would not want to see the inside of a C-119 flying boxcar? Or a Piasecki H-21 workhorse? You know, the old flying banana. And yes, David might be a bit annoyed with me, but I did not work my way into the cockpit of the North American F-86 Sabre, nor the Douglas A-4 Skyhawk. The playground-like atmosphere of the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum would by itself have been enough for Pueblo to be an airplane geek's dream, but there was still more. That was at Pueblo Memorial Airport itself. At an elevation of 4,726 feet, and with runway 8 right, 26 left, being 10,498 feet long, PUB could handle about anything in the sky at the time. Being a small airport in a small town, one would think there would be very little traffic, but that wasn't the case. Although few flights originated or ended in Pueblo, based on its proximity to Lowry, Buckley, and Peterson Air Force Bases, the United States Air Force Academy, and Cheyenne Mountain, there was almost always military aircraft shooting touch-and-goes. On any given day, I could watch A-7 Corsair IIs, T-38s, C-130 Hercules, C-141 Starlifters, and even C-5 Galaxies fly over my house at low altitude, either preparing to land or just taking off from PUB. Now understand that Pueblo, Colorado is located in what is called the High Desert and has all the flora and fauna associated with that climate. I saw burrowing owls, prairie dogs, coyotes, and most importantly for this story, magpies. Why would seeing a magpie be important to a story written about airplanes? Well, a couple of times, and I have no idea where they came from, but A-6 intruders flew some touch-and-goes at PUB. The A-6 was always one of my favorite aircraft, but it was in Pueblo that I realized that either an A-6 looked like a magpie in flight, or else a magpie was designed to look like an A-6. Either way, it was quite a revelation. But wait, there's still more. In the mid-1980s, United Airlines was re-engineing their DC-8 Super 60s with CFM56 high-bypass turbofans that made them into what became the DC-8 Super 70 series. The United Repair Facility and Training Center was located at Denver Stapleton, and again, since Pueblo was only 100 miles away and there was a big empty runway, PUB was where pilots trained flying touch-and-goes in these beautiful, newly reconditioned old jetliners. These aircraft were in service until they were replaced by 757s. I got to fly on one once and loved the old-style elegance combined with the new technology. I had the opportunity to talk to the first officer of that flight as we ended up in a hotel shuttle van together. He told me that he had more power and control with just 3 of the new GE engines on those Super 70s than he had with all 4 engines on the old Super 60s. You can imagine how much I loved to watch all those beautiful airplanes fly over my home. but it was in Pueblo I also learned that not everyone really appreciates aircraft at low altitude. I was attending a party with a friend. It was a big affair with a live band, held outside in the middle of the afternoon. A couple of C-130s were doing their standard approaches, and I was loving it. My date, on the other hand, said, "Why are those bombers ruining this party?" Once again, before I could stop myself, I heard myself saying, "Those aren't bombers. Those are C-130 Hercules transports. The first models came into service the same year I did, and if you don't want to be near them, you probably don't want to be near me either." Later that evening, she left with someone else. There are more stories to tell about Pueblo. My father and I on the ground with a Link trainer, loading a B-25 with sacks of flowers for an air show bombing run demonstration, and how I ended up in the right-hand seat for my first and only time flying in a DC-3. But we'll save those for another time. For the airplane geeks in Portland, this is your main man, Micah.
All right. Thanks, Micah. Yeah, we really do enjoy listener recordings. So if you've got a hankering to try it, we really would encourage it. We'd like to hear about an interesting aviation experience or that person that influenced you early on in your aviation career, anything like that. Have a go at it. It's easier than you might think. If you need some help sort of with the technical aspects of it, just let us know and we'll do what we can. So we always enjoy listening to Micah in particular. And if anyone else has some good stories they'd like to send along, please feel free. All right, just one more bit of listener feedback. We heard from Ian, who sent us a link to, he says, an interesting new UK series about flying in Indonesia. And this is called The Worst Place to Be a Pilot. And this comes through Channel 4. They call this a visually jaw-dropping series that follows young British pilots flying in some of the most breathtaking, remote, and dangerous locations on Earth. That's on Channel 4. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. All right, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. You've been listening to episode 313. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/313. We want to thank our guest, Kathy Babbas. Kathy, tell our listeners again where they can find out more about you and the NGA.
Well, if you're interested in finding out about NGA, our website is www.nga.mil. And if you wanted to contact me, you can do it through my comedy website, which is kathybabbas.com. And that's Kathy with a C, babies no E.
I love that. That's very good. All right. Max Trescott, tell our listeners where they can find more of you.
Oh, let's see. If you're interested in coming to the Silicon Valley, San Francisco Bay Area and going flying with me, you can look up my flight instructor website at www.sj, short for San Jose, sjflight.com, or go ahead and look for me on facebook.com, Max Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T-T.
All right, very good. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter. You can also find me and David Vanderhoof Fridays on the UAVDigest.com for that podcast that I do with David. It's been very exciting. We have a growing listenership and a lot of interest in what's going on in the unmanned aerial vehicle world. So you can listen to that on Fridays. And then also I co-host the PaxX podcast with Mary Kirby from the Runway Girl Network. You can find that at paxexpodcast.com. That's PAXEX for Passenger Experience Podcast.com. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. You can also subscribe to us through iTunes, or if you're on Android, download a Podcatcher app, and you can find us there. We're also on Stitcher.com and TuneIn.com. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us a brief audio message. Aunt Benet will tell you about that.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Next week is Labor Day here in the U.S., so we're going to have another Bits and Pieces episode. I know we've got some very interesting segments planned for that, so join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up. We are going to get some stand-up out of this, right?
I don't know. Max went to my website. It's mostly about not having a man.
Yeah, well, we'll be a good audience for you there. Those darn men. Oh, they're terrible, aren't they?
I'm looking for somebody that'll get me flight benefits and true love.
There you go.
Is that what friends with... Oh, flight with benefits. Okay, I got it.
Yeah. We'll see what we can do. We don't have a great track record in that regard, but we'll see what we can do. But yeah, I told my wife the pancake joke.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she liked that. She thought that was pretty funny.
Go ahead, let me hear it.
Well, I've been married more than once, and I figure marriage is like making pancakes. You got to plan to throw the first couple away.
Isn't that great?
That's cute. Yeah, that's really cute. I like that.